Charles Law has this. My name's Bruce, and I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't think I was obnoxious. On the other things, I'm not obnoxious. I'm basically here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And today, my home group is Steps of Sobriety in Saint Laurent. It's a Monday-Wednesday meeting, big book on Monday, and an open meeting like this on Wednesday. And it's been my home group since I came back from the slip over 3 years ago. That's where I originally met Danny and a lot of new people in my life. I chose that home group because it's big book orientated. I was thinking about it today because I just had a good conscience today. And the last thing we talked about was why did you join this group and why are you still here? And I mean, there's a lot of strong personalities in my home group. And for me, that's good because it's a wide variety of sobriety. I mean, you have a lot of long-term sobriety there. You got middle sobriety, you got young sobriety, and but you have a lot of gung-ho sobriety. You have a lot of people with 25 years that are still active, you know, and I like that. And they're still into teaching the big book and stuff, and that was my answer for why I'm still here, because I'm pretty well positive that if I'm not in the rooms and I'm not still active, it'll only be a matter of time before I use again, before I drink again. I've tested this theory, and so I know, and I really don't want to go back to testing that theory anymore. So where did I come from? I'm from New Brunswick. I come from an upper middle class family. Both my parents worked for the government, federal government, and my father was had a high position in the federal government. And because we come from a fishing village, so it's now it's a rich community because fish is expensive. But when I was young, it wasn't that way. It was, you know, it was very, well, for the customs that happen up here, fancy car, it's not like this up here. Down home, everyone, you know, we kill our own meat and all that stuff. And so I come from a pretty simple background, and but a weird family setup. My parents were married because I was born, and I figured that out when I was 4 or 5 years old, just by doing arithmetic. And they weren't happy together. I mean, it took them 32 years to figure that out, and they got divorced, you know, my first year of sobriety, but they stayed together a long time, miserable. And, but I was affected by it, I guess. The yelling, the screaming, I took it upon myself to blame myself that the only reason that these two people were together is because I was born. And because where I come from, when you have a kid, you know, it's not, you get married regardless. There's, love's not a part of it. Well, it can be, but sometimes it isn't. And they get married. That's it. And so I was affected by this. I lived with all my relatives when I was growing up. My mother left a lot. She comes from a really hillbilly kind of background. And she was unstable. And my father didn't know what he was getting involved in. And she left a lot, and I was, you know, I lived with my grandparents. I mean, I'm a big guy, and I was in the penitentiary system, and I went to the top of that. People freak out when they know that I can sew, and I can knit, and I can cook cakes, and, you know, my wife, people that know me, doesn't fit the image that I portray. So I grew up, like, with my grandmother, basically, when I was a little kid, and I had my first drink when... about 10 or 11. There was other substances prior to that. There was paint thinner, there was gas, there was stuff like that prior to that occurrence. But my first drink of alcohol was when I was about 10. And And that would be my first blackout and my first violent incident. And it was something to, it stayed in my drinking pattern. I wasn't a nice person when I drank. Well, I was for about the first seven beers. And then things changed for some reason. I became another person. And when I was 13 years old, I went into a blackout, and almost stabbed someone to death. And I was I went on a rampage. I mean, 13 years old. I wasn't born in Clyde, but it was like a rampage in my town. And then I moved it to other towns and stuff. And I ended up spending the rest of my juvenile years in a juvenile jail for kids, I guess. And I was released when I was 18 years old, and not very happy, as you can imagine. I'd spent all my basically high school years in prison, and because I wasn't a criminal prior to this event. I mean, a petty thief, maybe, you know, steal $20 in my father's pocket, but not, I wasn't a criminal until this event happened in a blackout. Someone almost died, and then I was shipped off to be with kids that were actual criminals. So I became a criminal while I was in this facility, because that was basically my high school upbringing, was with them, and that's what I set about to be when I got out at 18 years old. I took a hostage, had a kid at that time, and hostage, I don't mean like taking it, but I took hostage as a woman, my girlfriend, I guess, and I was set up in a job where I didn't have to work, and because my family owns businesses and stuff, my extended families, and so it wasn't pressed upon me that I had to actually show up. I was paid regardless if I was there or not. And probably it would be better if I wasn't there, because things would probably get running a little smoother. And so I sold drugs and was involved in all the criminal activity in the area. And that went on for about 4 or 5 years. And and it got out of hand, and basically charges started to come into my world. Assault of a police officer outside a bar. It was a bunch of little things that started to happen, and then I did the FI, which is something that I've done all my life, the fuck it, and that's what I said, and I took all my money and I went on a 6-month binge across the East Coast, and with a friend of mine and a shotgun. And that's what we did for 6 months, and that landed me in my first federal prison sentence. And it only got better then. So when I was in prison, I'm not very good with authority, so I don't do very well in prison atmosphere. That's always been a big problem with me. So when I was inside, I was shipped to a maximum security pretty well right off the top. It was only a 2-year sentence at the time, so it was my first federal adult sentence. And within 2 months, I was already in a maximum security. I'd been shipped up because of violence due to, it's moonshine, is what it is, drinking inside, and violence. Basically, I walked out of there when I was 23 years old, and I took a geographical cure. By this time, my sister had graduated university, and I was working in Ottawa. This is in the early 90s, and they had bought a house and everything, and they were doing well. And I took my parole to Ottawa. On parole. I took my 2/3, whatever it was, they kicked me out, and I was on parole, and I needed a place to go, and that's where I went to my sister's, and I had everything available to me when I was at my sister's. I could have worked for them. They owned about 4 or 5 computer stores already by that time, and I didn't do anything. That's what I did. I didn't do a thing. I didn't have a problem. I didn't think I had a problem. The only problem I had was I had to finish this parole so I could go vote my business, because I knew the parole hindered my freedom, and I had time to kill, and that's what I did while I was there. And 2 weeks prior to the finish of my sentence, then I just said, who cares? They can't do nothing to me now. I'm free. And I started to consume again on a regular basis. Before, it had to be hidden. And I moved downtown Ottawa. By this time, I'm, because I was pretty skinny little kid when I was small, by this time I'm pretty pretty big. When I had been in prison that prior time, I didn't work. All I did was work out and eat and smoke dope and drink. And so I have a pretty bad attitude by this time. And I'm pretty aggressive, and I'm not a small man, so it's for most people, I'm not small. This is the odd person I've run into in my life. And this is when it got really out of control in Ottawa. I moved downtown Ottawa. I seen things that I'd never seen in my whole life, because I'm from the East Coast and I'm a criminal. So there was things that I seen in Ottawa like that really impressed me. I mean, they're not really impressive things, but when you're a criminal, they're impressive. And you're in that world. And, you know, like, I'd never seen prostitution before in my whole life. I'd never seen crack cocaine. I'd never seen a lot of things. So when I went, it was like a candy store, and they let a psychopath in the candy store, and that's what happened. I became everything I wanted to be, basically. And, anyway, my habit was, I developed habits in Ottawa that were very expensive, and basically at this time I was drinking, but there was all kinds of other stuff, won't need to mention it, there was all kinds of other stuff involved, so I was into the more mode at the time, like whatever was on the move, pills and drugs and alcohol, I was a pimp at that time, and I was robbing anyone that needed to be robbed. You know, everybody, basically, that had money. And then it graduated into bank robberies. And that's when it got out of control. And so my big cure for Ottawa, because all the police were after me by this time. But my big cure was, I need to move away from here. It's Ottawa's fault. It's the cocaine's fault. I had nothing to do with it. Still, I moved to Vancouver. Is what my big suggestion, my big plan was for that. And I went out there and became a heroin addict, and that wasn't good either. And I finally got caught in Thunder Bay in 93, in the summertime, in the winter of 93, and was shipped back to Ottawa for trials and stuff for the banks. And basically... it wasn't pretty by that time. They wanted to put me away for basically the rest of my life. And I couldn't handle it. And I started taking bug juice at that time. I don't even know why. That came up in my mind a few days ago. I did it for about 6 months because I couldn't handle it. I was going to kill myself. And finally, I pled guilty, went to prison. The behaviors didn't stop while I was there. I got in a lot of trouble in prison. And I went to Millhaven in Ontario. And I got involved in a murder beef in 96 in prison. And involved directly result of drugs and alcohol dealing and purchasing and whatever. I was on the selling part of it. And someone died, and 4 of us got sent here to Montreal. Well, to the super maximum here in what's it called? Basin. No. St. Anne-de-Plain at the shoe. And by this time, they'd closed. There was only one shoe in Canada, and it was here. And we got shipped here, and basically one of the guys, we sat for a while, we went to trial, and one of the guys pled guilty. I had a really whacked out version of friendship at one time, because it was like, before I came here, all my friends were murderers. One of the guys that was charged in this crime with me, pled guilty to this crime, because he was already doing 3 life sentences, and it really didn't affect his life. And that's where I stayed. I spent the last 4.5 years of my prison sentence in the shoe, and under a 23-hour lockup, because by this time in my life, I'm not allowed to be with other human beings, not even the ones in federal prison. And I'm deemed a risk. And still, it's not my fault. It's your guys' fault and society's fault. It's the government's fault for putting me in jail to begin with. And so I went to... I was released here in 99 in the summertime. They had no choice, and you guys got stuck with me. Because no other city in Canada had the halfway house that would accept me. And so I had to spend the last third of my sentence in a halfway house in Park X. And it was something. I didn't know where I was being dropped into, actually. And it happened because I'd been across Canada, been in prison all my life, basically. And I knew a lot of people. The bar, it's called the Pam Pams on Jean Talon, and it was like literally 30 seconds from the halfway house. And my friend had just got out of jail 18 months before from a different jail, and now he owned this bar. So I had free access as much as I wanted. And and I was living in a halfway house, and I got out of control again. There came a time in March 2000 that I don't even know what happened. There was a bunch of things that happened, and I almost got killed and on 2 occasions within a couple weeks of each other, and I made a decision that something had to change. I didn't get hit by a car. That's not what I mean by getting killed. Like, I was risked against my life, I guess. People weren't happy with what I was into. And I made a decision that something had to change. I didn't really know what that was. I didn't even have a clue. Like, I really didn't know. I was just lost. I've been lost for a long time. And I hadn't taken... I've never asked anybody for help my whole life. I mean, since I was a little kid, right? I've taken care of myself, and at this time, and for me, just being alive by this time means I'd done a good job in that life. You know, that I was still alive, and about 2 weeks prior to this happening, there was a culmination of 2 fires here in Montreal and 2 other halfway houses, where all the people from that halfway house ended up getting shipped to our halfway house because they had no place to keep them. So those were under renovations and stuff. And it happened that 4 of them were from AA. They'd been to prison, they'd done their sentence, and they had found it either AA inside or when they were released to a rehab, and they actually all had gone in together to the same rehab, and they were all... You know, they were probably 6 or 8 months, 9 months at the time when they came into my world. And it's probably the first time in my life that I'd asked somebody for help. I really didn't understand what they were talking about because we had to do a meeting at this halfway house. So these guys talked about this stuff, right? Big book. I don't even have a clue. I thought they were fake, you know, because that's the world I'm from. And I asked them, and I told them I didn't know what's going. I don't know what to do, but if something doesn't change, it's going to be bad for someone or me or someone. And they directed me to a place in NDG called Addington House. It was in it. Well, when I went there, it was on Addington Street by the Legion, and they. So I went and asked my I don't even know what they called them, parole officer. Yeah, my parole officer, and she said it's about time. I'm like, what do you mean it's about time? Well, it's not a big way. You think you were kidding anyone here? I didn't get caught, but. You know, with the drinking and stuff, but they all knew. And obviously, if you look at my criminal behavior and the way I've acted all my life, there's some problem, obviously. And I went to Addington House, and I'd like to say I've been a very good boy since, and that would be not true, but... I just want to say it was probably the best decision I ever made in my whole life when I look back on it. I mean, I've made good decisions since then, but not such key life decisions. Because for a guy that comes out of the SHU, anyone who knows about prisons, the odds of staying out of prison are like 1 in 100,000. And that's the odds. I have it written down in paperwork. I mean, I have paperwork saying stuff about me being locked up for the rest of my life, but they can't do it, you know? And that's... Anyway... I went into that rehab and really felt out of place. I'd never done any of that stuff my whole life. I'd never looked at myself or done any kind of counseling, or I'd refused anything all my life. And basically, probably, I don't know why I didn't do it. Well, because I was obstinate when I was a little kid and as an adult. But probably subconsciously, because I really didn't want to know. You know, fear-based, you know, that I didn't want to know how really mangled I was and what kind of person, because I still had illusions, eh? Like, when I'm getting out of the shoe and I still have an illusion that I'm still a nice guy in my head. That's how sick I was by the time I got here. You know, some things weren't nice, but most of the time I'm a pretty nice guy. And I had this illusion in my head when I came to AA, and it was dispelled, obviously, in the attic, you know. And, when I went to Addington House, I thought I was screwed here, because you know, I sit back, and when you're a newcomer, you sit back in the back and you listen and stuff, and it's like, right? And then I'd hear my counselor, and because when I was in rehab, because it's at that time it was for inmates, but it was also for private people. So I had like a multitude of different kinds of people at my rehab. I had a couple millionaires, guys that would, you know, they were dropped off in a Jaguar, you know, like the JX8 or whatever, and, you know, with the wife with the big diamonds and stuff. And I'm like, because I thought that's what success was at that time, right? That kind of material stuff. And there was actually even a guy that owned a rehab when I was in rehab, but he was obviously didn't own it anymore. But he had owned a rehab prior to with another gentleman, and now he was in rehab. So this guy could like quote the big book almost, right? So I was like, I thought I was lost. I'm screwed, because the counselor's telling me that maybe one of you out of 15 are going to get a year. So who's it going to be? And I'm like, oh, it's not going to be me, obviously. Well, that's what I'm thinking to myself, right? Like, and anyway, I tried my hardest for 2 months to get kicked out of that rehab. I swear to God, like, when I look back at it, I mean, I did everything I did. I fought with other guys in there, flipped tables, had sex with all the girls in there. I did basically everything you could do to get kicked out of a rehab, and they still didn't kick me out. And finally dawned on me that these people didn't want anything from me. And because for a long time in my life, I always figured that... it's either I had to give something to something to get. It was a give and take thing. There was never, no one did anything for nothing. I didn't come from that world. And I didn't understand that these people wanted the best for me at the time. I didn't understand that whole philosophy. And it clicked in that they're gaining nothing. They're not going to get more money if I stay sober or if I go to jail. They're getting, you know, So I might as well go with the flow because it's not flowing too good in my life right at that time. And so I started to listen to suggestions, and I changed my appearance. My appearance wasn't too pleasing at that time for any, well, most probably didn't know any of you guys back then. It was like 7 or 8 years ago, I guess. And I didn't understand that I didn't know anything about society, regular society. You know, like how we're dressing here, normal, whatever. I came to meetings in muscle shirts because I was fairly muscular at the time. I had a shaved head and a goatee. This is how I appeared, like with the braided goatee, and that's how I came to meetings because I didn't understand how to act in society. And I was really resentful at you people because no one shook my hand because I'm reading literature too on the slide, right? Well, I'll read literature and I'm hearing things like the newcomer's the most important. Well, I'm not feeling the most important, so I'm getting resentment. These assholes from AA, they say they're going to help me, but no one shakes my hand. And I didn't realize that everyone was, well, not scared of me, but just didn't want me in their life. Like, I wouldn't want somebody like that in my life right now, like as my life is right now. But I wasn't, basically I shaved my goatee and started dressing properly and I let my hair grow back, and it changed. And instead of me waiting for other people to welcome me, I started to welcome other people because it was suggested to me that when I was about that, right around that time, because I was having difficulties and I started assimilating with the rehab, that I should stand at the front door and shake everybody's hand, and no big conversation because I really was scared to talk to anyone. I mean, I was a big man, but I was scared to talk to anyone because I was scared I didn't have anything to say. And just to say hi and tell them my name and just keep and just make sure I did that at every meeting, and it really worked for me. I think it was 2 weeks after I started that regiment, because we went to 4 meetings a week, and someone actually did it to me, and they came up and they remembered my name. It was a guy named English Ken, he's in NDG, and he remembered my name, and I couldn't believe it. Like, it blew me away, because regardless of what I was showing you in the world at that present time in my life, I felt like a bug inside, right? A little tiny bug that didn't deserve to touch your hands, really. And I felt like that a long time. I mean, I wasn't brought up to be the scumbag that I turned out to be. I was brought up by pretty moral people. There's nobody else that even has a criminal record in my family, in my extended family. And I was released from that rehab and. And, you know, they do a little thing there at the end of your rehab, like everyone talks about you, and they give their suggestions. And they all said that I was going to split, that I wouldn't make it, that's what it was. And I was like, I'll show you guys, I'll be the last one, I don't care, I'll go right to the end, right? So, because I'm a competitive kind of person, so I need competition to do anything. Well, it makes it more, and basically that's what happened. And once everyone slipped, I was the only one left, I figured, oh, no. There was a bunch of us, well, there's actually quite a few of us still around. The guy that's in your secretary, he was in my rehab at that time. There's at least 4 or 5 other guys that are still around the rooms of AA from that rehab. That first 3 years I got active, I got a police officer as a sponsor. I sought him out for obvious reasons, and that's who I hung out with for the first 3 years of my, well, not three, 2 years of my sobriety, because they got boring after 2 years, so I quit them. But and they were really good for me. Buddy used to pick me up in his undercover car at the Half Wheels and take me to meetings. You know, like I'm in a federal Half Wheels, he used to pick me up and take me to meetings and then drop me off after. And we used to go to Picasso's or Benedict's and eat supper every Wednesday. Life really changed for me. I started doing weekends, intensive weekends. And when I mean life changed me, it changed me really quickly here. I mean, I basically came here with a kit bag, and within a year and a half of this program, because I always judged everybody by the material wealth they've had, they have, when I was before, and for success. That was success, was material wealth, right? That's what kind of what I come from. And so that's what I strove for. So I worked like a dog. You know, jobs, weekends, nights. I had a regular job in the daytime, and you know, I bought a car right away as soon as I came here. Within a year and a half, I owned a condo. I went nuts, and plus I did meetings, so basically there was no sleeping happening. And I started taking credit for what happened here after about 2 years. You know, that I was the one that did this. That you guys had nothing to do with it. It was all my. Their soul came back. I let him back in because there was nobody else. I didn't replace him with God when I came here. I replaced him with material things, and now I know material obviously is not the way here. I did some big book stuff when I was first around here, but I ran every time that we came to certain parts of the big book because I was very fearful. I was scared anyway. Now I've done it a few times. It's cool. But at that time, I'd never done a four-step and all of it. I had the big boogeyman in my head about the four-step and doing the steps. That I was petrified. I couldn't even put a pen to paper. And then I'd find a way to argue with someone, and then I wouldn't have to do it. And that's what happened for about, I did two or three of them 13, 17-week workshops, and I never finished them. I started, and when we got to that, right about the time when we're supposed to say we're done the fifth step, well, that never happened. And basically, just before my 3 years, I'm already married by that time, so I didn't make any too many life changes. Married now, I've sold my first house, I bought my house in Beaconsfield, I own my own company and material wealth all kinds by this time, and I'm not sober enough to handle it all. Basically, that's what it was. When I look back at it, I had no sobriety. I had no mortar between the bricks. When you read the book, it says it in there. I had no mortar. I had bricks. They were just like there on the ground. But if you walked on too funny, they would flip. And that's what happened. And so with culmination of a bunch of resentments, because I wasn't taking care of that problem either, because I, you know, when I first came here, I found that I could talk. You know, I could let them fly. And I was a newcomer, so everyone accepted it. But after a while, I found that, okay, well, now I have 2 years. I'm supposed to be weller, so I'm not going to say anything now because that would make me look like I'm not well, right? So I stopped talking, and I just kept these little things inside until they became big things. And I started to use marijuana. It was my first... I figured I'd smoke marijuana and still come to meetings. That was the whole, in my sick mind at the time. And no one would know. And that was, obviously didn't work out too well. Everyone found out. And so basically I stopped coming to meetings. And, well no, that's not true. I was still doing meetings because I picked up literally 45 chips that year. Started drinking again within a month. And cocaine came back in within 2 or 3 months, and basically my life went really to hell real quick. And within 11 months, I'm back in jail. And basically, I hadn't paid any bills for 11 months because other things were more important than the bills. So my truck payments and my car payments and my mortgage. Well, we can let that slide and borrow and. My wife got fed up of it, and she filed for divorce when I was, by this time, my wife's sober, too. She's 15 years sober now, or 16 years, and this is like my flip. That summer of my flip, I always had this dream that I was going to grow all these huge, monstrous marijuana plants. So I did it on my front lawn in Beaconsfield, you know, like retarded. At the time, I'm not well anyway. You know, like I'm back into it. My attitude's back. I'm back to the same old Bruce. I don't know that though, because I'm still hanging out with a few of the friends I made here. And, you know, I got 8-foot marijuana plants in Beaconsfield. I don't know if anyone's ever been out there, but it's not much different than what it is right here. Houses are next door to each other. We had high hedges. That's the only reason I could get away with it. But it wasn't like, you know. So my wife got fed up with it. And I ended up in jail. Now I'm not sober. I'm living on First Avenue machine. And basically, I hadn't lost my job that year, but not because I was like the best worker, that's for sure. And they kept me on, and I went on a big mission in December, three years and a month ago, I guess, a couple weeks, and I don't know what happened. Well, I know what happened, but anyway, I made a decision to pick up a newcomer's chip on January the 1st, 3 years ago. And you know what? What I find when I look back retrospectively, because I was fed up about 20, 30, well, a lot that year, but I was fed up like 30 times that year. And I picked up a newcomer's chip like 30 times. I swear to God, I got like a, well, I don't have them anymore, but I have a bunch of them lying around the house in different spots. And that I picked up that, but the last time I picked one up 3 years ago, it wasn't any different feeling from the 30 I'd picked up before. So I really don't know what happened January that first. Because I was, you know, I was fed up a few times prior to that that I didn't want to use anymore, and then somehow 3 days later I'm on a mission again. How did this happen? And waking up on First Avenue in Verdun. It was kind of lucky, I guess. Not lucky. I'd done a lot of good work the first time around and helped a lot of people. Really, I didn't know that I was helping these people. I was just doing what, you know, come natural, driving to meetings, pick them up, newcomer guys and stuff, and help them out. We go play sports together, Benny Park and baseball and all these things. And for some reason, that January the 1st, a few of those guys were still, well, a few of those guys that I'd helped like 3 years before were still sober. And I met them at a meeting. One guy in particular, and he was there when I picked up the newcomer's chip, and he basically pounded me for the next month and picked me up and phoned me and, you know, got me involved in a 17-week workshop right away. I think the night I picked up the newcomer's chip, or if it wasn't that night, it was the second night that I picked up the newcomer's chip. After I picked up the newcomer's chip, that I was told that I was going to do a 17-week workshop. Basically, I knew that there had to be some changes in my program this time for me to stay here. And I was scared of what's on the other side for me, because the other side for me is not like going downtown and sleeping on a park bench. It's going to be going in prison. I'm never going to be out again. It's what's going to be for me. And so, you know, I have a lot of fear about that. So I made the decision to tough it out, and I must say that it was tooth and nail for 3 months. I didn't want to be here, man, because I'd never experienced that. Because I was in the hospital when I first came here. So I didn't have like VPs and all that stuff, because I could only do controlled use in the happy house certain times, because I was having urine tests and stuff. But this time I was full fledged, and my body really was craving some stuff when I came back this time, and I struggled. And anyway, I made a commitment to that 17-week workshop, and we finished it. We went through it. By this time, I had already got a sponsor and a home group, which is still my home group. And me and my wife got back together about 6 months after. We started dating again and doing those things. And, you know, we didn't just get back together. It was, there was some work involved. And I got involved in a lot of service when I came back this time. And I knew that that's very key, you know. Like, for me, I got to be involved because I'm not a guy that's going to stay sober sitting on the outside. And, you know, like today, that's all I've done. I've done AA all day today. I was out of good conscience for 6 hours before I came here. I had a nap before I came, but, I mean, I have to be in the middle. I have to be involved in stuff. I just finished my two-year term as a GSR for my meeting, and I just finished, actually, Thursday night. And I learned a lot, we'll say that, about what goes on in AA, and that I'd rather make coffee. That's what I learned, really. I'd rather make coffee and set up chairs, you want to know the truth. And politics is not for me. Since I did that first 17-week workshop, I did another one, and more as a leader, kind of, than the newcomer. And we went through our steps again there. And after taking 2 years this year, I had a bit of a crux in my program. I started to feel that way I was feeling before I slept the first time. And I was at that time, you know, I got 2 years and a little bit. And not that I wanted to use, because I really didn't want to use the first time, it just happened, kind of. But I felt that there might have been some attitude. And for me, I can stand in front of a room and tell you all kinds of foolishness. Like, I could talk here for 3 or 4 hours, but I won't talk on the phone right now. Okay. That's the guy that actually helped me and his friend. that actually took me my 17-word workshop. We're still pretty close. And my problem is intimate one-on-one relationships. To be real with someone, one-on-one. That's my biggest problem in life. And I knew this. And I knew this was going to have to be dealt with. But I figured I could put it off for a little bit longer. And this year I took care of it. I actually changed my sponsor at first this year. And that's kind of another good thing for being around for as long as I have been. I know a lot of good people. I know what goes on in their immediate life, not just their 1 hour a day, because it's real easy to be sober here for an hour. Much harder to be sober for 22, 23, and 24, right? Those last 2 or 3 hours of the day. What I mean by sober is not drinking. I mean, it's not the not drinking, it's the behavior, right? How you treat your family, how you treat the you know, the world. And I picked a guy that really, I mean, he's like, basically you can quote the big book, so I kind of helped him out for a while, went to his house and had supper and we discussed and talked and see if there could be like a friendship, because I needed that. And well, that's what I've done all year this year. I mean, we just finished the big book. We did the 164 pages. I made a commitment. I went every Tuesday night this year for like 4 or 5 hours every night. Went to his house, we had supper, got the big book out, pen and the paper, and went at it. And another, you know, it's something that's really been good for me. What else? Basically, life goes on. I haven't been the totally most honest guy since I've been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I really still had resentments against government. So I own a company, and it's been for a few years. And the shitstorm of taxes is in my world right now. Big time. You know, like, because I didn't buy houses and cars and all that stuff, but, you know, I had to do, I wasn't paying taxes, basically. And, I was, but very minimally. And, and that all this stuff has caught up to me in this year of my sobriety. So, and you know what? I'm not that, I was freaked out for about, you know, when the lawyers and the auditors and everybody comes into your world. I've never been a part of that before, but, and, so it could have been a really bad thing. Well, I don't even know what it's going to be yet, because it takes a while for that stuff to happen. But, it's not going to be life-threatening. You know, and I'm not really worried about it anymore. And that's what my program is. Because that's something that could just, like, I could be, like, on a jet plane, you know, like, screw it all, the F's, the F-I's, and, you know, something that big, like they're going to take my house and all these things, like, it could happen, you know, and it's not going to, but it could have, and that's where I see my growth, because that's something, like, I could turn into a really big thing in my life, and it's not that big a thing, because really it's only financial stuff, and it can be had again or given away. Who cares? I don't really care, because my whole idea of the financial world and what makes a person has really changed since I came here, right? Like, money means, you know, obviously it's important, we need it to live and survive and have a decent life, but it really means nothing but what the person's all about, you know, what car you drive and all these things. For me, it's about, you know, like, I don't really like people saying nice things about me. This is the big problem. Like, when Danny says nice things up here, I cringe inside. The knot in my stomach. Someone says something nice about me. I don't know what that is about, but I'm pretty sure I do. But I'm more like the guy that does the anonymous things, and I don't really want to be known for it, because it makes me feel... I get funny inside. I feel funny inside, and then I have to act out when people give me compliments. And So basically, I'm here for life. I think I've changed a lot, especially in the last 3 years. I still have a lot of character defects, but I'm really into, like, looking at them. You know, my opinionatedness and my self-centeredness and all these things. I'm into looking into them. I don't know if I'm willing to change them, but I'm into looking into them. Because it doesn't say that I have to change them. It says, right now I'm not only... Because that's a hard part of the program, I find, is the seventh step. Like that, you know, that I'm going to say I want to change, I'm going to pray, and they all disappear. It doesn't, obviously. And I figured out that maybe I'm not willing to let some of these things go in my life, right? And I hope they do. How long am I supposed to speak here? Another hour? Only been speaking for 37 minutes. That's pretty good. First time I spoke for an hour and a half, Saturday Night Follies. You want to see people out the door, baby. Woo! Anyway, I'm very grateful. I have a lot to be thankful for. My dog just almost died this week. I have three West Highland Terriers, and the littlest one almost died. Some sort of disease he picked up. Not disease he picked up, just something in his, you know, random, like a human would get cancer. And he was safe on Thursday night. And I have two kitties, and I have a wife who loves me. And a roof over my head. And I have a lot of good friends. And I have respect in my family, which I only had... embarrassment for my family. They're embarrassed to me. And it means a lot to me that I can be there for them and their struggles. See, it's kind of turned around in my family. I'm not the one that has the issues now. It's other people. And where I thought I was the one that had all the issues when I was a little kid, and it really wasn't me. It was I was old enough, my brain wasn't old enough to conceive the ideas that I was thinking. You know, that they got married because, you know, because this all really started in my mind when I was a little kid, because I thought it was all my fault because my parents got married because of me, and it really had nothing to do with me, you know. They chose to get in the back of the Buick. Anyway, anyway, I just want to... I want to say to the newcomer that there's a lot of choices. There's a lot of choices that you're going to have to make as a newcomer. And as you're going along in sobriety, that, you know, that there's a fork in the road where you can make easy decisions or you can make hard decisions. And hopefully you make the hard decision. It really, in actuality, the hard decision that you think it is at the time, it actually was the easier decision in the long run. You know, because you're staying sober. And I've been out there on the other side of the fence, and it's fucking painful out there, man. And I don't want to ever have to go out there. So I believe that, I mean, if you don't feel it yet, stay here for the miracle. You know? Keep doing what you're doing, and you're going to either hear or you're going to meet the right person that's going to show you where the miracle is here. And I believe that's what's happened to me. You know, I've met a lot of good people, and I've been shown that there's a miracle here. Thank you.